Hello and welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money, and ultimately helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas, and with me today is also co-host Alex. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Jonas.
But more importantly, we are joined by an exciting guest. We are happy to have Co-Pierre Georg with us today. Since September 2024, Co-Pierre is a professor of practice in digital finance and technology at the Frankfurt School of Finance and also director of the Frankfurt School Blockchain Center, where he succeeded Philipp Sandner. So Co-Pierre, it is a really great pleasure to have you in our podcast.
Thanks, Jonas. Thanks both. It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to the discussion.
Perfect. Thanks for accepting the invite. And maybe let's directly go into the episode today. And maybe, you know, that the listeners can understand you a little bit better, like where you're coming from, what your background is. So when did you basically start to research blockchain and digital money related topics? And how did this come? Because you do have a background in academia, you worked at central banks, right? But when did this interest basically arise? And how did you come to these topics?
Yeah, I mean, originally I'm a physicist, and like most physicists, you do everything except physics. So I did a master in physics in Karlsruhe, then did a PhD in economics in Jena. And I had the fortune that Jena at the time had a graduate program that was sponsored by Bundesbank to finance PhD students. And I had one of those bursaries. And the nice thing about this program was it was half econ, half law. And when you come in, you had to do both courses. So we had like a US style graduate program, getting it proper training, as much as you can train an economist in legal matters, you know.
Well, the responses are always the same, Copia, right? It's always, it depends. So if you're an economist or a lawyer.
I think the lawyer struggled more with the econ than the economists with the law, because they had to do the math all of a sudden. I think that was a bit tough for them. And but it was a great program because you see both sides of the coin, so to speak. I then worked as a postdoc in Madrid in the math department, because my thesis was on systemic risk in interbank markets. So basically my interest was in sort of methods inspired in physics, but then applied to financial systems. And after the global financial crisis, there was this big interest in interconnected financial systems. What's the role of interconnections? How does it lead to contagion? What can we do to mitigate it? And that's how I came to Bundesbank, which I joined in 2012, I want to say, in the research center. And I worked there, I want to say 9 years until 2021, in a pretty epic deal where I spent 3 months a year for most of the time, 3 months a year in Frankfurt, and then 9 months a year at the University of Cape Town, where I was a professor. I came to blockchain, I think in around 2017, 2016, The Economist had this big article, The Everything Machine. And I remember we were at the American Finance Association meeting, which is like the big econ meeting, with a couple of central bankers going for dinner. And since I come from sort of the statistical physics, I did a lot of payment systems. And sort of my buddies were also all payment systems geeks. And it was always a bit boring to be a payment system geek and to sort of be interested in this. And then with blockchain, that changed completely.
So, Co-Pierre, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure if you can remember, it should have been in 2018 or 2019. I think we have met at a conference. I think it was called Short-Term Funding Conference. I think it was in Washington, maybe, or so.
I remember that.
You presented a paper there and I presented a paper there. So yes. It was still your interbank research times. I was happy to see that you are moving. I think you're still doing research besides crypto blockchain, right? But I think you're moving now more and more into the, of course, given your new role, into that blockchain space.
Yeah. So once you're interested in payments, blockchain actually was a revelation, because payments were always a bit boring and people would, you know, look at you sadly at conferences when you tell them, oh, I'm interested in payments. I would say, oh, I'm so sorry for you. And with blockchain, that all changed. And, you know, suddenly we were the cool kids on the block. And that's when I started a master's in financial technology at the University of Cape Town, because I thought if we really want to make an impact, we have to teach hard skills, meaning coding, meaning sort of the practical stuff. So I designed this master's program with sort of students from disadvantaged backgrounds in mind. That launched 2017. And it was insane. I've never seen anything like that. My secretary was on the phone yelling at people to just leave us alone because we can't handle all the demand. We had like 400
applications. So this was the ICO hype, right? So this was the wave up?
That was the first big wave. And I mean, some of my students did ICOs. Actually, one did an ICO that made like $20 million. And he came to class and said, you know, this whole university thing isn't for me. Mic drop, I'm leaving. Oh, and by the way, we are hiring. If any of you want to come, I have to say that was a pretty. I was pretty amazed by that. I wouldn't have done this as a student. Like, I wouldn't have had the guts. So that was pretty cool. Then we sort of taught the hard skills, and I wanted to have students that actually start companies. So we set this whole thing up so that they can do a 2 years master's, that they have a bit of time at the end to actually start their own companies. And that has worked really well. So we've started 7 or so companies by now from the hub. I was involved in 2 of them to also see a little bit like the startup stuff. I was interested in sort of privacy and as a topic, and we can talk when I tell you a bit about the center, we can talk more about that. But that's sort of what I did in Cape Town before we decided to move back to Europe for a variety of reasons, personal reasons with family, but also because I felt like there's a bit of a ceiling that I'd hit. We could grow the center and we could do more things, but we had been doing lots of work with all the policymakers. I've been involved in the South African retail CBDC, both from the central bank side and then later also from the solution provider side. So I did work with Algorand to put up something that could compete with Mastercard. So there were 2 teams sort of pitching for the digital rand. It was Algorand Consortium and then Mastercard. So that was a really unique experience to see this kind of big project like really up close. And then after sort of that concluded and the central bank decided to do rapid payments instead of blockchain based, I thought there wasn't so much more to do, and I got this chair in blockchain between University of Zurich and University of Cape Town. And by the time sort of all of this was done and dusted, Frankfurt School had this, you know, this opening, of course, because Philip passed away. So that was a really difficult decision for me, because I had known Philip for a long time, and sort of I really appreciate everything he's done for the community and for the ecosystem and all the work. I felt a bit of like there is a certain responsibility to make sure that the center sort of can move forward, can transform, and you do need a bit of experience in how to build a center like that. So I was really torn. In the end, I decided to go to Frankfurt to, you know, take over the center, try to develop it further and make sure that it doesn't, I always say collapse, but that it is the best version of it.
So, I mean, I guess that's exactly the question I would have had for you since you're now leading. I mean, you're a professor, of course, at the Frankfurt School. Now you're director of the Frankfurt School Blockchain Center. It's good to hear that you already have experience in like leading centers. So I guess you have your own ideas, your own plans. So maybe you can talk a bit about kind of what you have in mind, where the Frankfurt School Blockchain Center is going, like topic-wise, maybe where you want to put your emphasis, but also maybe are you introducing new programs? Is the structure going to change? Would be interesting.
Yeah. So when I applied, I pitched a vision of the center that would be a bit more academically focused than what it was before. Until now, it was really very practical. And I think it really was a hub for a lot of the activity in the crypto space in Germany. That was tied to Philip and his special personality and his, you know, his charisma and the way he could take people along and lift them up. That would have never worked for me and sort of where I come from. Like I like my research and I try to write papers on a variety of topics, not necessarily blockchain, but sort of, yeah, I like that research aspect, and I'm just a very different person, like personality-wise. So I figured, okay, I have to give it a new pitch. So, okay, first thing is it will be more academically rooted. It will be more practical in the sense, more technological. So we've done in the past, I've been involved in the tech development of, you know, prototypes for the startups of, you know, new tech. I was the first economist, I think, at the University of Cape Town to ever get a patent for something that we built. My dean didn't even know what to do with it. Like, normally you would get some bonus or whatever, but since that has never occurred, they didn't know, okay, how do you deal with that? So that's the second thing, right? I want to make it more tech development focused. And so from this was sort of the big vision, like do something academically oriented, more tech development, and then think about which topics. So when I came in, I have my own ideas what to do, but I thought the best thing is to have sort of an open process to like let everybody suggest topics and then vote on them. And that's exactly what we did. So the 2 topics that we voted on were central bank digital currencies, that was a pretty easy pitch, given, you know, Frankfurt, it's almost a no-brainer. I think with the digital euro, more likely than not coming, I think it's also important to be active there. I want to say to support, but also to, you know, critically engage with the ECB on this process, because I think it's a big project that's important for society as a whole. And everybody that has of experience should play a role in shaping it and making sure that it is what we want it to be. And I figured with the experience I had from South Africa, but also from my work with Algorand, where we participated in a bunch of tenders across the world for different projects, both with central banks, also with large stock exchanges, also work that I've done with like World Economic Forum on some of the working groups on interoperability. I figure that's something, you know, that's a no-brainer topic. We have to do this. Everybody agreed. It's going to be one of our topics.
I think you also have, if I'm not mistaken, like a central bank center at the Frankfurt School, right?
Yes. Exactly.
So that is another.
Very good. Yeah, that was part of the idea that we wanted to collaborate more with them because the Center for Central Banking is super strong at Frankfurt School. Emmanuel Mönch was the previous head of research at Bundesbank. So for a time, he actually was my boss.
Great guy.
Yeah, really. So exceptionally strong researcher, really great guy. I was one of the reasons to go to Frankfurt School was that they have a lot of really good researchers to work with. And also Jens Weidmann with his experience and infinitely deep Rolodex of connections. You know, I figured this is a great topic for Frankfurt School, for the location Frankfurt as a whole, because I see us mostly as supporting the financial services industry in Frankfurt, but also in Germany or in Europe, to serve the industry in a positive, like in the best way of this word. So that can be critical, the service sometimes. It can be enabling. But I want us to sort of have this sort of front-end center that these are the most natural partners for us, like financial services institutions. Yeah, leverage this. So central bank digital currencies. The other topic that came out is blockchain as a foundation for digital property rights. And that's something that's really close to my heart, because over the years, economists, you know, they've approached blockchain and crypto always very skeptical. Like there's, if you go to normal econ conferences and you talk about crypto, there's a small community now, but it is still a bit of a niche topic. And most mainstream economists will have a long list of grievances. I have a long list of grievances.
I usually, sorry to jump in quickly. What I did for a couple of years was, you already mentioned the AEA and the econ and the finance, biggest econ and finance conference, academic conference in the US once a year. What I did for a couple of years, I was counting how many, let's say, presentations, and there are, I would say, hundreds. So more than 100 definite presentations throughout those days. And it was, I think the peak were maybe like 10, 11 presentations on crypto, Bitcoin, blockchain, and so on. And I think last time I counted was like, I don't know, 22 or so, and it already started decreasing again. It was below 10. I'm not sure how it is today, but it's definitely not center stage at this at this conference.
No, not, but there is a community that has emerged of this. I mean, some of these folks, they are studying more the risks and sort of like implications for mainstream monetary policy, or like, there's really relevant open questions that you have to ask, but it was always a bit more of a niche topic. But sort of the thing that I got so excited. So when you would talk with them, they would say, "Ah, who needs blockchain? We don't know. Like, it's a problem. No, it's a solution waiting for a problem," and all of these things. And I thought, yeah, let's think a little harder and a bit deeper about this. And I had a sabbatical in 2019 that I took to go to MIT for a year. Like when you get tenure, you get to take a sabbatical to reevaluate your life. And that's exactly what I did. And I thought, like, what's the most important thing that I can think of to actually spend my time on? And what I came up with was this question of, how do we control our data? Is the current infrastructure that we have to control data really the best we can do? And is there a way to use blockchain to actually create a new form of data control, a new form of empowering people to manage their personal information? And that's still what sort of drives me a lot these days, to think about, like, can we use this? It's the only system I can think of where you don't have a central controller, like, deciding whether you get access to a database or what's in the database, right? So it's a system that, because it is decentralized, allows a governance of data that centralized systems don't. And it's the first time in history, in technology history, that we have that. So that's, for me, this is like, how can we use blockchain to create data infrastructure? So that is sort of the second big thing that I'm excited about and that the center will focus on. So that was also the vote number. The topic number three that came up was this whole question of crypto risk. We feel there's a lot of people talking sort of all the positive things of blockchain and crypto, but that there is not really like a place where you use all of these things that we've learned about systemic risk and sort of the lessons from the financial crisis and try to translate them into what's happening in crypto. And I think there's a role that academics can play in that space, right? To use these new tools that we've developed after 2007 and 8, which really was a wake-up moment for all economists, right? It's very hard to find an economist of that time that doesn't sort of feel even a little bit bad for not calling out the problems before they unravel. I mean, this was a major moment for the profession, right? So I think taking some of these learnings and applying them to crypto can be a service also to the crypto community, because there are things that we need to talk about, you know, openly, frankly, among friends.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So you mentioned three topics now: CBDC, ownership rights on blockchain, or data governance, control, crypto risk. Who exactly voted on these topics?
I mean, we have a couple of research associates, and everybody who was still a research associate at the time voted.
So it was basically your team or the team
Exactly.
It was not, let's say, the university itself among the professors. Okay.
No. If I had asked them, the vote would, maybe CBDC would have come out.
Yeah.
The other topics, I don't think so.
Crypto risk, probably, I could imagine as well.
Yeah. So I ran this by our university leadership and say, we might want to look into crypto risk and establish a crypto risk observatory with a couple of universities together, and they loved the idea. So yeah, maybe.
So speaking of that, how exactly is actually the blockchain center integrated into the Frankfurt School? Can you maybe, I have understood now you're a professor. Are you kind of teaching like courses besides what's part of your, let's say, center, or are you fully like involved in your center? Is the center kind of fully integrated into the school, and in particular also financing? We all were good friend of Philip always had this issue that he had to raise money, right? He did all these conferences and stuff, had partnerships because he had to kind of finance the center to a certain extent. Do you also still have that pressure?
Yes. Let me take a step back and say the centers at Frankfurt School have a special role. We have departments like a finance department, an econ department, law and computer science. So we have different departments. What very often happens at universities is that people engage within their departments with their colleagues, but not across departments. So there's a few ways to break this up. Centers are a very elegant way of doing that, because centers can work across departments and they have a role of facilitating things that a normal department wouldn't do. Industry interactions, sort of practical things, like where a normal research-focused department just, it's not their priority. And that has been the case with Philip, and that is the case now. Philip had a particular independent streak, I would say, in the best positive way, right? He did things with a speed and a determination that every university will struggle to keep up with. I think that's just who he was, right? For me, part of my role is to bring the center closer to the rest of the university, right? So to make sure that we have more engagement with the researchers, that we have more engagement with the other centers. And Frankfurt School centers usually have a structure where you have a research professor and a professor of practice, and they sort of together run the center. And they report to whatever the leadership at the university. In central banking, for example, Emanuel Mönch is the research professor. Jens Weidmann is the professor of practice. Mm-hmm. For the blockchain center, we don't yet have that structure. And basically, there's only me as professor of practice running it. We hope that soon we'll also hire folks that are research professors, pure research professors, to sort of be the counterpart. I wouldn't call it the pressure, but the idea of make sure that you address a community, and the best way to making sure that you do that is to partner and get sponsorship and funding from the industry that still exists, and that is with us as it is with Philip. Maybe with a different focus a little bit, because I've started to sort of write grant applications for more research grants rather than industry projects, because I think part of the truth is also that these industry projects, they were very exhausting. like in the center, there's always been quite a high turnover of people just because it is hugely demanding to run all these projects, to make sure all the deliverables are hit. And especially after Philip's passing, I think there was a time where everybody really burned the midnight oil to make sure everything would go. And I don't think that's totally sustainable. I think we have to find a new balance for that. And it will be more research focused, which is reflected in that as we have the turnover, as we always had with the center, new positions are being filled by postdocs. So we just hired two new postdoctoral researchers that will join us in September, reflecting this strategic shift towards closer connections with academia. It's not to say that we don't want to engage with sort of the community. We still do that, especially through the Crypto Assets Conference, which we will continue to organize because it's a very nice event. It fits very nicely with the DEC. What we've done this year is we had an academic conference the day ahead to bring in also some more policymakers, because I thought that's something that my background can bring, to have more central bankers and more people from policy there. And I think that's what we're going to continue to really, it was missing a bit, like this academic input.
I agree. I mean, it was, of course, Philip's strength, as he said, to bring the whole community together. He created that out from nothing, right? And that's, of course, huge. But also, I think the academic, like deep research part was missing a bit. And I mean, I very much appreciate that you are planning to focus on that. Of course, it would be great or very important, and now I'm talking as a representative of that ecosystem also professionally, that this ecosystem doesn't die and we do only research, right? So that would, of course, be great, but more research will definitely help and is urgently necessary, in my opinion.
Yeah, let me just say this. I think there's two concrete things that will happen. One is we have been hosting these talents programs. I think they are one of the great successes of the center. The truth of it is that they are also a huge strain on the resources. I think people do not realize the dedication and the effort that the research associates put into this. Or maybe they do, but it's still an enormous undertaking. And it doesn't fully align with the strategy or what we want to do. Also, I think that the community has grown and has reached a certain maturity that it doesn't need us to do this. So at the moment, we are talking to potential partners to actually take these on, because I think they add a lot of value. But it's not necessarily what we can do as a center. So I think the whole Web3 talents program should continue, must continue. But I'm not sure that we are the best place to do it. Also, especially because things like, I'm guessing we're going to talk about Bitcoin later as well, but Bitcoin talents is a particularly hotly debated topic, right? I'm skeptical of Bitcoin, and still I wanted this to exist and to continue because I thought it's important to not superimpose my own opinion on everybody and just give room to this. But I think in the end, it's all these talents programs, they need to find a proper home where it aligns. And we have some nice ideas and you'll hear about it. But I think that's important. And then maybe to add this, the first thing I did when I came in after this, sort of we find new topics and we make sure that the strategic realignment with what the school wants and how the other centers work at Frankfurt School happened, is to start a master's in financial technology that's coming live in September. And that's a reflection really of my first meetings with industry, to hear them out, what are the skills you need. But it's going to be broader than blockchain. Blockchain has a role, plays an important part of it, but it's one third AI, one third blockchain and blockchain related topics, and one third platform economics. So it's a different focus from what was there before, and I think it speaks more to like how do we train the next generation of innovators to transform the industry as the industry itself is going through this massive change, technology induced change. I think that's the challenge for university, and Frankfurt School, to their credit, they pushed this through in a speed that I've never seen at any other university. Normally, it takes 2 or 3 years to get a program like this going. We did it in 6 months to get this off the ground. It's absolutely amazing. And I think it's going to be a fantastic program that takes a lot of my time, and my teaching will be on that program. Mm-hmm.
And maybe the one last question, Kupia, before we go into the topic of Bitcoin, because here, of course, we are very interested in your opinion and also in discussions around that, is again, on the role in theory versus practice, because I agree with Alex and with you that more academic research is needed, maybe also was needed to, you know, previous times, let's say. And also you want to make the center more oriented when it comes to practice. But you also said, you know, let's say practice in the context of technology, right? So there is also this practical component of like where we had this, where Philip was really a superpower to bringing people together to talk to these stakeholders here, talking on this high level, then going very deep with that stakeholders, right? What do you think? How can this theory and practice basically brought together in the context of crypto, right? And maybe also which role the blockchain sector can play besides what we discussed on, making this a progress, because I agree, it's on us basically, to discuss this, because this just brings society forward if we do these discussions and do have these progress.
Yeah. I think it's not easy to do this. And normally economists, they don't engage too much with technology, because what do we have to say about technology, right? And in reality, it's difficult to do both. Why I'm happy to be in the position at the Frankfurt School at the Blockchain Center is because I have this sort of practical stuff that we did with the startups I was involved in and with the research I did and sort of with the central banks to try to bring all of this together. So what I see as the main thing is this technology development and sort of helping researchers understand what matters because technology is changing. I can give you two examples where it mattered. When we did the retail CBDC pilot in South Africa, it was an engagement with the whole central bank. Basically, every department had to send people to this thing. It was a huge undertaking, cost a lot of money and effort for the central bank to do it. And the questions that they asked were questions where researchers had nothing to say. About disintermediation. If we do a retail CBDC, will banks be disintermediated? We don't know. How does it affect the credit multiplier? Will there be effects on monetary policy? We don't know. I felt that something like a blockchain center has a role to tell researchers, these are the things that matter right now. You better get cracking on finding some answers to this. And at the same time, tell the policymakers and the industry, these are the things that we know from research. And there are some things that, research just doesn't have an answer to yet. So be careful here. And that's how I see the role, and that's sometimes more pleasant than at other times, because sometimes you're the bearer of bad news in both directions. If you tell the researchers, look, guys, it's nice what you've been doing, that's basically not what is needed. And it's a bit irrelevant. That's not nice. And if you tell the community, look, research gives you a different answer to what you would like to hear, that's also not nice. But I think it's important to do this because everybody will be better off.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I mean, first being that, let's say, speaker or that channel through which practitioners can better understand where research stands and what's kind of the takeaway, because I can tell you, I mean, that you know this as well as I do, but I in particular realized that when I left academia and research, no one in a bank is reading papers, right? Maybe some banks have small research departments where some people might read an academic paper from time to time, but no one is reading papers in practice. So having someone who kind of digests this stuff, summarizes it, and kind of gives away the main takeaways is super important. But then also, as you said, the other way around, being a bit of an antenna, realizing what's actually going on and what's needed. Because one thing that I realize and I read from time to time academic papers on crypto things, some of them are actually very relevant, but of course, given academia runs a bit slower than the practice, and in particular the crypto space, for instance, very famous paper from 2019 about illicit use of crypto, which uses data from, I think, 2012 or 2010 up to 2017, 18, 19, something like that. I mean, it's super interesting result, but it can hardly be used as a reference by now, because since then, the market has completely changed, right? And that's just always a lack of a couple of years. So anything we can speed up, of course, also tremendously helps.
Yeah, that lag is difficult, right? I completely agree. It's like it's really hard to sort of draw these inferences from previous data, and it boils down to how much do you value the peer review process, right? There's this, okay, yeah, the market has changed. I think nobody will doubt that. The question is, how do we have any sense of how it affects the results in those papers? And the illicit financing is one thing. I think any sort of like industry insights will be, it's a much smaller fraction than it was before. In absolute values, I don't know. It's a bit more tricky to decide. I would always advocate to say, you can have discussions on different levels. You can have a discussion around the practicalities where you accept to deviate from the requirements of peer review. And then you can have sort of more recent things that you accept as part of the argument. Or you try to sort of base everything on the peer review and on peer-reviewed papers and sort of the rigor that they bring with them and sort of what we can take as ground truth. As a professor, it's sometimes, especially in this field, right, it's difficult to thread this needle. Where I can, I try to do this, like listening to the peer-reviewed and what the literature says. Sometimes you have to sort of deviate a bit from that and accept market insights and things like that, and then actually reflect on, does this square with what I know from the peer-reviewed stuff?
Jonas, I know you want to move on to the Bitcoin topic, and we're almost going there already. I still want to ask one last question, because this question came up a couple of times also in our community, and I in particular want to give you the chance, Copier, to comment on that. There were a couple of, after this Arte discussion round, one kind of criticism that was swirling around a bit was that you are, or some of your research projects, not you personally, but of course research projects you're involved in, are supported by crypto foundations. I think Ripple is one, Algorand you've mentioned already is another, and I just want to give you the chance to comment on that and maybe explain like what that actually means to have a research project that's supported, and to what extent basically your thinking and your doing is impacted by those projects.
Yeah, I've heard this that sort of people took offense to sort of my criticism of folks going on TV and, you know, pushing a narrative that personally benefits them financially directly. They said, oh, but you get research funding, aren't you sort of conflicted? And I think it's important to clear this up a little bit as into how research funding works. When you get a grant like this, there are sometimes mechanisms where it funds papers directly, but that wasn't the case for me. So I went out to get funding for the University of Cape Town, and all the money went to the University of Cape Town. It did not affect my salary. I didn't have more money. Didn't
for
even
you.
Write. No, as a professor in South Africa, you're fine. It's okay. And also at Frankfurt School, it's all right, you know. But it doesn't affect sort of my personal financial well-being in any way. What the money did, though, is it funded bursaries. First and foremost, we had dozens of students, actually, and now in Cape Town, pretty much every student gets a bursary. And many of these students couldn't study if we didn't get the bursaries. So I am at any day of the week willing to defend getting funding for the students. Doesn't affect me. I don't write paper with them. I don't get more money. All I have is a bunch of paperwork. But I believe that if we want to transform the industry, we have to make sure that there are pathways for people who couldn't sort of study these things otherwise. And the only pathway that I can see is if we get these kind of grants and bursaries. I always felt a bit, yeah, it's still important to disclose this, right? So that when I teach my class, there's always this slide in the beginning with a CV where I have all the funding and like where I worked before, just to make sure to tell the students, look, whenever I talk about Ripple or Algorand, just think, you know, bias, 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 make sure that you take this into account. But there's a normal way of sort of engaging with third-party funding, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and I think that's the right way to deal with it, and just to protect a bit the other people that were sitting with you in that round. I think also for them, it's totally fair to be invested or to profit from crypto as long as you make that transparent. And I think all of them did or do that usually because they're very well known, then it's totally fair. Yeah, you can't forbid anyone to talk about crypto just because he or she is invested. There just needs to be transparency, right? About
oh yeah, that. Of course. No, it's not about sort of limiting what they can say, but it's about making it clear to the people who listen to the debate that there's sort of different interests here. And in my mind, there is a genuine difference between sort of benefiting from something personally versus trying to make others benefit from the funding that you get. And I didn't anticipate that people would sort of conflate these two things and take it as a point of criticism. Otherwise, I would have already said on Arte, look, this is my disclaimer here, just so you guys know. I, to be honest, since I'm not on social media, I wasn't even aware that there is like this huge bubble in which people take this so ultra serious. I'm more aware now, I have to say, like the social media team at Frankfurt School told me, you know, there is X, and you know people are really riled up on X, but it's that, yeah, and I I try to say at the end also, like, then most of the criticism I have for Bitcoin actually applies to most cryptos. I wouldn't necessarily separate between them. Like, you can make an argument for many of them, for a lot of the criticism that I brought. Bitcoin is a bit special, and I think it's worthwhile looking into this more.
And that's maybe exactly, you know, use this to disentangle this a little bit more, because that's also, I think, something that is very interesting for us to discuss, you know, from economists to economists. And I think also very relevant for the audience, because as you said, you know, also in the Arte Doku and on other media appearances, that, you know, you do see crypto. I mean, if I quote you in translated form, like you said, crypto is for me a spin-off of blockchain technology that serves purely speculative purposes. So I think from this you read, you know, that you're not very bullish on that, let's say. So maybe you can elaborate a little, Kopia, like how do you reach this conclusion, or how, you know, how did you come to think that?
Yeah, I mean, so you can't do your PhD in 2011 coming out of the financial crisis and not think about risks and systemic risks. And that's what my thesis was on, right? How interconnected systems lead to systemic risk. So for many years, I've been teaching Bitcoin as part of my course, because I think it's of historical interest to include it in a class. I think students need to know about it. I've always sort of covered this, but I've never felt the need to speak out like what my concerns are about it. That has changed because of three things. One is MicroStrategy, and it's going to be my first sort of major concern at the moment. The second is the US decision to have this Bitcoin strategic reserve. And the third and sort of most imminent thing was the discussion at the German parliament around whether Germany should have a strategic reserve. And I had a discussion with a senior professor, a friend of mine, and somebody from the block. You know, we get together once a month to, you know, just talk about all things crypto, and I was going on about all the things that concern me. And my colleague at one point said, "Well, look, if you're so concerned, you really need to say something. You can't just keep this to yourself, because 2007 we missed the mark." So then I said, "Okay, if that's the case, then I really have to try to make this argument." On Arte, it wasn't the best way to make it. Right? I'm the first to say, "Look, this could have been way smoother." But I think it's important to have this discussion, right? So let's talk about some of the things. And at one point I made a list of like what bothers me, right? Or what I'm concerned with. And that is like, I think, 6 economic risks, 3 technological, 3 societal risks. I'll try to be sort of brief, but I think MicroStrategy deserves special attention. That is for me the single most problematic development in that space right now. Because what they are doing is they are issuing debt to buy an asset that doesn't pay off dividends. And that was fine as long as they could issue debt that was long-term and didn't have a yield. So they didn't have to pay any interest on this. The latest issuances of debt that they had, that's not the case anymore. So the analysis I found, not peer-reviewed, right? This is industry now. So we are moving into what does industry know that research doesn't know yet, is that they are already on the hook for $140 million in actual cash payments to their investors, I think, until the end of this year. This money cannot come from Strategy software business, because that has been making losses for years. The only other thing it can come from is from new investors or from selling Bitcoin. Michael Saylor always said he wouldn't sell his Bitcoin. I find this so, for lack of better words, so stupid to manage expectations like this. The moment they will sell any Bitcoin, you don't know what this does to the psychology of the market, right? If somebody says, "We will never sell, we will never sell, we will never sell," and then is forced to sell for whatever reasons, that is a problem. I think that's a dangerous development. And the only other way they could do it is to raise money from new investors to pay off old investors. There's a name for this. That's a Ponzi scheme.
And you're saying this is more than just idiosyncratic risk of one company failing. You're saying, because MicroStrategy is so big by now that this would have ripple effects for the market as a whole, so to say?
Yeah, that's exactly the concern. And actually, so this ties into the second sort of concern I have with that. I wouldn't know what the right market cap for Bitcoin is at the moment. I know what CoinMarketCap reports, but what CoinMarketCap reports, you just take the price and you multiply the coins issued. That is not a proper thing, because it doesn't take into account any kind of illiquidity spirals. But in 2008, we've seen that as soon as you sort of start seeing large liquidations, you don't know exactly what the amplification effects of this will be. The moment you have a large risk like MicroStrategy in a market where liquidity is not clear, and I'm not saying that it's not there, right? There is liquidity that makes it relevant enough. I'm saying I wouldn't be able to tell you ex ante if there is 100,000 Bitcoin liquidation coming from MicroStrategy, or because the next US president, if there ever is going to be one, thinks differently than Trump and liquidates the reserves that they now amass. Any event like this has amplification effects that I wouldn't be able to tell you how large they are. I know that there's an amplifier that is likely to be larger than one. So that's a concern. Yeah, that we don't have proper metrics, robust metrics for this.
That's actually a fair point. So kind of to say we need to more properly measure that, maybe to a similar extent than we do it with traditional markets. Just to give you a couple of numbers that I have in mind when it comes to, because I also took a look at that at one point in time, like market depth and liquidity. I think Bitcoin by now is properly liquid when you look at the kind of average daily trading volume. This is not that far away from major stocks like Apple and Microsoft. So the numbers I have seen is like Bitcoin spot between 10 and 30 billion a day trading volume. When you look at really the biggest stocks, we are at maybe 40, 50, 60 billion. So let's say 50% of that. Of course, what we don't know, to be fair, is how deep is the market really if someone tries to sell at a very short amount of time. And here we only, I mean, we have a couple of case studies. For instance, the Saxony had to sell, I think it was 80,000 Bitcoin, if I'm not mistaken. And Bankhaus Scheich, Tradias did that in Germany. And it took them not too long. I would have to lie like 2 weeks or so, OTC, of course, mainly, to get rid of it without impacting the market. I'm just giving you a couple of, that gives us a bit of a feeling of how deep that market is. It's, of course, having to sell on one day 100,000 Bitcoins, that's a different story, right?
But that's exactly the problem, right? Normally, fire sales in the academic literature are not a concern if not the industry as a whole is affected, right? So the problem is that these fire sales occur during moments when the industry as a whole is affected by whatever event it is. And there are a couple of things I could think of. So that's the problem here, that we don't have a more robust way. Normally, as long as Bitcoin and crypto is small and is a novelty that is interesting to study, you know, all is fine. But basically, we have a whole industry that developed around something that has the size of a like daily trading volume of a single stock. That seems risky to me, right? So at the very least, I think the industry should push for proper stress test, if you want, right? That's what we've learned after the financial crisis, that even the best laid regulatory measures aren't enough, and that there are macroprudential effects that need to be taken into account. So again, we're talking about risks and not things that will happen with certainty, but these I'm trying to sort of rattle off things that are risks that make Bitcoin different from others. I can continue a little bit if you want, right? So the next one is Tether. It has been on my list for years as the second. So when I teach my students, I always say the biggest risk for crypto is political risk. It's, you know, regulatory stance shifting overnight. Gary Gensler coming in was the case study. He was actually at MIT when I was there, and he was always part of the digital currency initiative when I was there as well. Even during these like seminars, he would say, well, if ever he had to go after crypto, he would go after the exchanges for listing unregulated securities. That's pretty much what happened, what he did afterwards. So he was very transparent about this upfront. So political risk is the biggest, followed by Tether. Now, I think there is an interesting academic debate around Tether. There's this 2020 paper by Griffin and Shams, Bitcoin Untethered, that made some waves. There is a recent paper by Hannah Halaburda from NYU, where she takes the same data and comes to a bit of different conclusions. So the Griffin and Shams conclusion is that Tether gave credit to Bitfinex, and Bitfinex bought a bunch of Bitcoin with it, and that moved the price. Hannah's conclusion is a little different. She talks more about sort of frictions and market microstructure being the driving force here rather than governance issues. The gist, though, is that Tether doesn't do proper auditing. From what I understand, they have a letter from an auditor, but it is not a properly qualified audit.
It's an attestation. Yeah, it's not comparable to an audit.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't understand why the industry is so chill about Tether not having an audit. Because there were points in time in the past where they have done what FTX did. They have done customer money and invested it in something that was more risky than they advertised up front. And again, as an economist, I'm not concerned about Tether individually. I'm concerned that this is the ingredient for a bank run. And for bank runs, there are two fixes in the literature. One is deposit insurance, which doesn't hold here. You don't have that. The other one are redemption gates, which is what mutual funds have to prevent these kind of outflows. But Tether doesn't really have any of those, really. We don't know what it does. So if ever Tether comes into any form of trouble, there is a possibility of a bank run equilibrium coming, and there's no policy, no regulation, nothing that would stop it. And they sit on how many? Less than 100,000 Bitcoin, more?
Oh, I would have to check, but they have a couple of billion in Bitcoin. Yeah.
So that's a concern, right? This is the kind of size where you need to be concerned about. And they had this like agreement with the New York State Attorney General at one point about doing some shady stuff.
Yeah, like an 18.5 million settlement in 2021. To be frank, I would be less concerned about the Bitcoin that Tether holds. I would be more concerned about the size. I mean, it's 120, 40. I don't know where they stand. Let's say 130, 40 billion at the moment. And if this turns out not to be properly backed, I mean, at the moment, if it's true what they report in their attestation, it looks fantastic. They have, I don't know, 10 billion or so, or even more in excess capital. But if that's not true, of course, the whole market would have a huge issue. Yeah. I agree.
The problem is not so much the fundamentals. They are a problem. The problem is that a lack of transparency can lead to equilibria where coordination failures occur. That is what happens in bank runs. It's a coordination-driven issue. It's not the bank that suffers a bank run doesn't have to be insolvent. It can be a coordination failure. And that these dynamics, they can be stopped through proper policy and transparency. So at the very least, I think the industry should push Tether harder to produce proper audits, because even if they don't reveal new information, the trust in these audits can help alleviate these coordination issues.
But isn't that happening in Europe? I mean, Tether had to be delisted now from all kinds of exchanges because it's not in line with what MiCA regulation. It wouldn't be in line with the regulation that's currently debated in the US, Genius and Stable Act.
And they said they will leave now, right? So they said they also don't want to go into the MiCA territory now.
Yeah. Look, to be completely honest, I'm a bit skeptical of MiCA for a variety of reasons. I think they went overboard, and I think it's a bit protectionist of the banks in what they did. I wish... And I actually had a debate with someone yesterday about whether it's possible for stablecoin issuers to get access to the central bank facilities, not just to the central bank payment system. If you're an e-money provider, you can get that,
right,
but to the actual facilities. Because with that, you would have a perfectly safe asset. Therefore, there's no bank run concerns. The only thing you would have to do is you have to charge fees rather than do the floating thing that Tether does. But that would be fine. I think that could be a European answer. And MiCA does make it much more difficult than it should be. So I'm not sure legally if it's possible right now. That was the big debate yesterday over lunch. Is it legally possible? Maybe it is.
I mean, I think at the moment it's legally not possible for e-money institutes, what stablecoin issuers would be e-money institutes, to get access to the central bank facilities. But I mean, you can change that, of course. In the US, in Europe, we are very narrow in who gets access to central bank facilities. It's usually banks, right? In the US, that's broader. So we could easily change that. I think it's less of a legal issue than what the political will is, in particular of the European Central Bank. And they are very much against granting stablecoin issuers access to their facilities.
Yeah. I think they need to rethink their stance.
Yeah. And I think, Alex, you know, if we look at the podcast, I think we did podcast episodes on this topic like 3, 4, 5 years ago. definitely agree here, Kopi. And also, I have to say that, you know, a lot of points I would also agree on the challenges that you mentioned. And what I would now like to do is go a little bit more on, like, say, Bitcoin itself, because what you mentioned, the systemic risks, I mean, I also do see some of them, but, you know, bluntly speaking, I would say it's not Bitcoin's fault. It's Bitcoin's fault, basically. It's if you say, you know, the crypto space is hacked, but if you look at the fact, it's not Bitcoin that is hacked, but it's then, you know, an unregulated exchange that is maybe hacked. So maybe we can go a little bit deeper into what your concerns are around the product, let's say. So the product Bitcoin itself, because you mentioned quite, you know, a few times that you see this primarily as a means of speculation.
Yeah.
And I would be very interested to understand that.
Right. So, okay, very good. So for this, it's important to have a brief look at the different narratives, quote unquote, or the different versions of Bitcoin. The first version was, and that's where I got most interested, oh, this is a new payment system. You come from payments, you know that all the things about correspondent banking that are bad and make it expensive and don't work for emerging markets. And you think, oh, maybe that's a cool new payment system. But this has not panned out at all. It is really the worst payment system that I can think of, because the transactions per second are too slow. It's way too expensive. The numbers I found was like $1.50 on average for an on-chain transaction, while rapid payments is basically free, because the central bank assumes those costs. The amount of value that is settled on Bitcoin for retail payments is minuscule. I found this one data from CoinGate where they come up with something like 10 million euros for retail payments in Germany in 2024 settled in Bitcoin. That's minuscule, right? So it has failed as a payment system. So why am I concerned about this not being a payment system? It's because there's a paper by Martin van Oort looking into what's the difference between, you know, a speculative bubble and an equilibrium where there's a sustained price of crypto and of Bitcoin in particular. And the answer is it depends on whether you can create enough interest in your payment instrument.
Demand for transactions.
The demand for transactions, right? So if that demand isn't there, and it's not there today where Bitcoin is, I don't know if it's an all-time high. I'm sure I would get some emails of people that have watched Arte tell me just how wrong I am, right? So if it's not there today, I'm really skeptical it will be there in a couple of years when central banks have caught up and have provided products that actually fit the market better than the old way of you know, in the US, I still got checks. It's insane. We see a wave of payment system modernization. And I don't think Bitcoin can compete with that at all. So if I take that research serious, I don't see how we have any underlying sort of utility that would move it away from the bubble equilibrium, from the Ponzi equilibrium.
And I think we all agree that, you know, Bitcoin really is not a mainstream payment system now. And this vision, you know, that Satoshi like once had, I think this is like didn't materialize yet. Maybe it will not. I'm also more on the store of value case, but I would like to discuss this next then. But Kupia, you could also say, if, like, playing devil's advocate here, is what I personally think as well, is that Bitcoin is there as an emergency payment system. So whenever all the systems are down, you know, you have it, you can use it. And I think even this feature, similar how, you know, you can use gold for specific purposes, I would argue that even that has a specific purpose. Or if you look, for example, at resilience or uptime, right, we have seen, I think, if we look into wholesale payment system, of course, it's not fully comparable, right? But we did see like two outages of Target in the last 10 years. We didn't see this for Bitcoin. Like, I think the last one was 2013, if I'm not mistaken, right? So I agree, it's not used everywhere, right? But isn't this emergency backup system that seems to be super resilient, isn't that kind of a use case itself that gives it at least some value, so that you would argue it's not completely speculative? You wouldn't say
ask
so.
Ask the people in Spain and Portugal that had the power outage the other day, just how well Bitcoin worked. And the answer is, didn't. Why?
I mean, yes. I mean, you need connection, obviously, for
exactly.
that as well.
So
yes.
That's why in the digital euro, the whole offline payments is such a big thing. It's because there are considerations for what if there's a power outage. In South Africa, we had power outages all the time. And power outage often means that internet goes down, because these internet cell towers, they have like a backup for 2 hours or so from diesel or batteries. But if that runs out, that's just
It's a question to what you compare it, right? So if you compare it to cash in an offline system, of course, you know, it's not resilient. But if you compare it to other payment systems that are by nature also digital.
But then can you tell me the scenario in which a normal like nation state backed payment system would go down and Bitcoin doesn't? It's like there, I'm not saying there are none, right? I can probably like I would have never thought the Target could go offline, and whoever messed this up at ECB should be asked some really tough questions about how this can ever be possible. And there are certainly cybersecurity sort of concerns, right, around around Target, if you want. But I think that sort of threat surface is, or that number of scenarios is so small.
I mean, it's really hard to say, right? But I mean, I'm even surprised if we see this. Like, we had the terminal failures last year. We had PayPal outages, I think, also last year, right? So I agree, Kopi. I don't, like, there are not a lot of obvious reasons, but also I would have expected a lot of the outages that we have seen. So, you know, you never know. And I think the cybersecurity aspect that you mentioned is very important. Also for the Digi Euro, it will be super important to get this super bulletproof, because that, for example, could be one reason in this, you know, geopolitical, like, let's say, crazy times, right?
So I'm, to be frank, I'm with Kopier on that one. I also don't see Bitcoin ever becoming kind of a payment system, in like emergency payment system. I think, and Jonas, you already alluded to that point, that store of value argument, because I think also in times of stress, it could develop into something like an emergency store of value, or store of value in general. And Kopier, just to kind of build that bridge to the paper you have mentioned from Van Oort, I've also read this paper, and he has like these two components. One is the stable equilibrium can come if there is transaction demand for transactions. And then his other component is, let's say, speculation, or like I'm investing into Bitcoin because I'm expecting the price to increase. And there are other papers that are a bit similar that also argue a lot from the transactional activity that needs to be there for Bitcoin to have value. And I always wonder whether there isn't something we miss here, which goes back to that speculation or expectation of increasing prices. That's not only speculation. And I usually call this like kind of a monetary premium. And that's something that gold, for instance, also has. And it's basically a price of an asset that's above and beyond the intrinsic value of that asset, or what that asset would have as a value if you only measure it against how can it be used, right? And gold is for me always the perfect example. Another example is actually the fiat money we use today. So a bill, a 50 euro bill, of course, its intrinsic value is like probably a couple of cents, but we all agree that it's worth more because it has a monetary premium. And this monetary premium has been created by, of course, institutions and laws and so on, while the monetary premium in gold has been developed over thousands of times. And I always wonder, couldn't it be the case that we are currently on a path towards something like a digital gold? I would fully agree that we are not there yet. And investing in Bitcoin today for me would be more a bet that we reach that point at one point in time.
Yeah, I thought about this a lot because it's the current narrative, right? So if I try to compare Bitcoin and gold, then you can look at the market structure. Gold is traded by mostly regulated entities, Bitcoin by mostly unregulated entities. Not saying that there's no institutional demand for Bitcoin. There has been, it has been growing, but a lot of the actors in that space are not as tightly regulated. If you look at the operational risk of storage, while that's well understood and managed for gold, while there have been, I did a search the other day, like 60 cases where exchanges get hacked, like significant cases where exchanges get hacked, wallets get hacked, bridges get hacked. It's less well understood. Regulation is not so clear for Bitcoin, while it's totally clear for gold, which is classified as a commodity. The liquidity for Bitcoin, we had the discussion just now, whether it's a trillion or 2 trillion, is still a fraction of what it is for gold, which makes it really relevant for central banks, because central banks don't maximize profit. They need reserves with high liquidity to actually manage their FX, right? So I would say it's a long way from sort of being comparable on that front. As a safe haven asset, you can make an argument that there have been flows into Bitcoin when there's trouble. At the same time, when we had relatively high inflation in 2020, 2021, Bitcoin also wasn't doing so good. So it's not like the natural safe haven that I would say gold is. And you can see this with the price of gold. The volatility is something like 4 to 6 times higher than the volatility of gold, again, making it difficult for central banks to accept it as a currency in its basket. There is moderate correlation to S&P 500 for gold. For Bitcoin, it varies, but you did have periods where it was large and positive. So it's not a good hedge for S&P 500, I would argue, because I would like something that's negatively correlated, especially when things aren't going mm-hmm. so well, and we haven't seen that. And there's a big tail risk. We had 5 drops of 80% or more in Bitcoin. With gold, there's only 1 of a 70% drop, and that was, I think, over a period of like 20 years, right? So all these things make it in my mind, separate from gold.
I would definitely agree, Kopi, and also going back to what Alex said, that we are not there yet, right? But I think with some of the aspects that you mentioned, like the substantial volatility, also this very high loss, you know, very high drawdowns, very high correlation to tech stocks, generally, rather than what gold is, you know, kind of negatively correlated. I think that's all true for today. But you know, that's, I guess, something that could emerge in the future. So that's why I'm, again, coming back to the question of the product, because that's, again, a consequence, right? So I'm personally more thinking of what features does this product Bitcoin have, right? And how does this compare to gold? Because as said, I agree, we are not there yet. Look at the market cap of Bitcoin versus gold. It's 1/10 of that. So we are definitely not yet that, there yet, difficult words. But the key questions, what I'm also wondering is, you know, are we on this path to go there, right? Or, you know, or not, right? And that's also why I think I would agree today, but I would see a lot of the factors you mentioned that could potentially change over time.
Maybe I would then ask, as an economist, you should ask it anyway, should we be on this path? So what does the society look like if we had a widespread adoption of Bitcoin? And so that's like in this sort of list of grievances that I've made for myself, you know, this is like the last three things. Like, what's the societal impact? When Bitcoin was created, it had perfect inequality. There was one person in the world that had Bitcoin, everybody else had zero. Gini coefficient is one. Over time, this has been going down, but the distribution of wealth in Bitcoin, if you look at the overall world, is significantly more unequal than even South Africa at the end of apartheid was. And so I would ask, if this is sort of the system that we have, where we have wealth distribution that is so incredibly unequal, is it really something that we want? Do we really want to export this inequality from the crypto world to the real world? Because there's, and you had, I think Jürgen Scharf was on,
yep,
just now on a podcast, he has this paper looking at sort of what does Bitcoin mean for inequality. And you can model this, and you can very quickly see that if we were to sort of accept it as a savings instrument for large parts of the population, that inequality that is built in Bitcoin because of the way it is created would be exported to the rest of the world. And that's something that I would say we should be very cognizant about. Do we want more inequality in the world? Or why don't we agree on another version of a cryptocurrency that looks more like a universal basic income? If we really wanted to, you know, help folks in emerging markets, if we really wanted to do something good for society, is the design of Bitcoin really the right one? And I would say it's probably not. So that's one. Like, I can go a little more into some of these others. This issue of illicit activities, right? You can argue all you want that it's lower than it was, and I would agree with that. Nonetheless, if you read Andy Greenberg's Traces in the Dark, that chapter about child pornography and the role that Bitcoin played there, you cannot leave this book not thinking that this is so abhorrent that we really have to think about the payment instrument that makes it possible. Because child pornography is not a cash-based business, right? And we've created a system that was designed, I think, to avoid some of the existing regulations, some of the governance. If you read David Golambia's The Politics of Bitcoin and the Right-Wing Origins of This, and he means it more aggressive than it should be, it's really about libertarian origins of this, which don't have the same negative ring necessarily. But it was designed as a way to get around existing regulations. And some of these regulations we actually have for a very good reason, right? So do we really want to sort of embrace a system that was designed to circumvent some of the things that we have to prevent the worst of the worst?
So let me maybe quickly comment, and we won't kind of have time to discuss those things.
I think
to
we
the
need
end.
3 or 4 hours to disentangle everything.
But just quickly on the distribution part, I think that's the very few. So the inequality, like how wealth is distributed, I think that's the very few points in Bitcoin where actually the data speaks in favor of Bitcoin. Because I agree to everything you said before with illiquidity, volatility. That the trend we see is that Bitcoin are, if at all, getting better and more equally distributed. So I just wanted to mention that trend. Just one question. I want to make sure that I understood you correctly there. Did you say that by design, and I don't want to misunderstand you there, by design, Bitcoin mm-hmm. leads to unequal distribution of wealth?
Yes. So let me be very clear here, right? At first, when it is created through the way it is mined, the first Bitcoin that was mined was allocated to one person.
Sure.
That is just the, if you compute the Gini coefficient at that time, it is perfect inequality. One person has everything, everybody else has nothing. So as we have progressed, Bitcoin has become in its distribution more equal. I completely agree with that. But it is already exceptionally unequal in how it has been created. So now what we are doing is we are linking this with the rest of the world, with the fiat world, right? And that world is less unequal. So the question is, what does it do when we do it, when we combine this? And Jürgen's paper with Ulrich Binzer has an answer. It increases inequality in the non-crypto world. And that is my criticism or my concern here.
Yeah. So let me comment on the second one, just for the sake of time. You said illicit use, and that's a topic I struggle a lot with as well, just for the lack of good data. And of course, anecdotal evidence speaks a lot in favor of it's all the time used for illicit purposes. I just want to mention for fairness that there's, of course, always a trade-off, right? You can have 100% safety and security, but this would mean we all have to stay at home the whole day and probably not even move around at home because you can cut your finger with a knife or fall in the shower. So there is always this trade-off. And I understand those people that say, I value freedom a lot and open ecosystems and the possibility to have full control over my own wealth, be independent from governments and so on. But I very much, of course, understand that side that says there have to be rules in order for us to work and live together, and of course to prevent those things. So I think that's more a way of, do we find the right balance and can we put Bitcoin into a framework that allows us to avoid those things while still kind of allowing that degree of freedom that the other people value?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the debate that we need to have. That's also why I think it's important to for academics to speak up and say something about the things we see going wrong to contribute to this debate. I think it's time that we reevaluate our stance towards Bitcoin. We have a very accommodating stance in Germany. I've written about sort of what I would call a tax benefit, which is you had Jürgen Schaeffler on the other day that amount has his price tag on it because he very cleverly got this over the years into our regulation. I think it's time we reevaluate and as a society decide, are the benefits of it really worth the risks and really worth the adverse effects? And it's something I struggle with as well. I would at the moment argue, I don't see enough benefits that in any way compare with the risks that I can see. Because the benefits that people bring, they are very often intangible, hard to measure. Ideological, if you want. What I can see are the downsides. I can see people getting paid in crypto and starting to spend it without the concerns of having to go through a bank where, you know, those pesky taxes are due. That I can understand. But is that something that we should encourage as a society? I would say no. I would say this is not, at the moment at least, it's not worth the downsides and the risk. And I wish the industry and the community would come together and really actively think about, okay, so we had this great vision at one time. That vision, I think, has been corrupted over time with players like MicroStrategy. Let's go back and think about what would it mean if we are cognizant of all the bad things? How would we have to change it? Because Bitcoin has to change anyways. The moment quantum computing comes online, there's a moment where you need to actually rethink this. So I think that's a good point in time now to have this debate.
And I think it's also interesting, Kobia, because you know we look all through this from the lens as economists basically, but basically deriving very different conclusions. Because for me it would be, I mean, I would agree with a lot of the risk vectors that you mentioned, for example, around MicroStrategy, Tether, and Co. But for me, actually, the benefits actually are for me more prominent than the risks. So I think that's generally interesting. But what I definitely, I think it's great that you do, you know, at the Blockchain Center, and also why we, you know, at this podcast want to have opinion from all sides and discuss and you know, understand more the challenges, is to really to have this discussion to bring the space forward. Because if people all the time time say Bitcoin is super good for ABC reason, and people say, oh, Bitcoin is bad for a DEF reason, right? It doesn't bring us together. So it just brings us together if we, you know, if we discuss and challenge that. And I think that's really also an very important contribution also on the research side, because it often lacks, as also Alex said, and it lacks data, also like illicit activity, energy consumption. I think it's hard to have these debates because the data are just so bad currently.
So let me maybe go back to my VC analogy. And I think if we are all now VCs considering whether we should invest into that project named Bitcoin, I think Jonas, you and myself, we probably are just a bit more optimistic about that all these issues that we all see, and it's hard to debate about facts and data. I think we all agree about those facts, right? About the volatility, about the illiquidity, about the potential illicit use. But I think we are just willing to invest. Let's say it's a series. We are not business angels anymore now, but maybe it's a series D or so, right? We would be willing to invest because we see like we see that upside. Why Copair is probably the investor that says, look, too much downside. I'm not convinced yet. I'm happy to help kind of pointing out the difficulties and doing research around it. But I will not jump on the train at the moment.
Actually, I would go further. The comparison for me is with Teflon and PFAS. It's a great technology that makes a lot of things easier, but the adverse effects of this are so bad that researchers, these forever chemicals, that researchers have pointed out that we can't let this go on unregulated, that we need tight regulation around it, that the health and safety issues need to be addressed, and that you can't just sell this stuff unregulated. And so it's not just that I wouldn't invest, I would actively lobby and encourage stronger regulation and a new political dialogue over how we deal with this pollutant.
So we are happy to kind of create that platform, Copia, and have you back in the future to continue this dialogue. It was great to have you on today. I think we could have gone on for way longer, but I would say let's leave it there. Thanks for being part of that. Thanks, Jonas, for organizing all of this, and then happy to continue that discussion at one point in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thanks for also the critical questions. That I think it really is important that we have these discussions, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, thanks dear listeners for listening in. Thanks for giving us a good review on your podcast platform, and then until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.